Welcome to another exciting episode of Not in a Creepy Way, the podcast where the Brothers Anderson will dig deep into the movies. The Brothers Anderson are... This is Eric.
It is better to be truthful and good than to not.
This is Brother Jay.
You ask me if I have a God complex? Let me tell you something. I am God.
This is Drew.
There is a storm coming like nothing you have ever seen, and not a one of you is prepared for it.
And they are sometimes joined by guests like...
This is Travis.
I had to stop her from screaming.
And Diane.
If you men only knew.
So sit back, close your eyes, and let us take you away. Unless you're driving, in which case keep your eyes open and watch the road and, you know, anyway. And welcome, this is Eric.
This is Drew.
And tonight we're going to talk about the 1991 Jonathan Demme movie, Silence of the Lambs. This will be our third Hannibal Lecter movie.
Indeed. This is the first one that captured the nation's attention.
And really led to all the others. So for good or bad, except for, of course, Manhunter.
Right.
The thing about Silence of the Lambs, and we talked about it after talking about Red Dragon, was that I went into it with a certain amount of apprehension. I was worried that it was not going to live up to my memory, because I hold this as a brilliant film, at least in my memory.
Yeah, I was in the exact same headspace as you. I was really worried it wasn't going to hold up.
And what do you think?
I think it's good. I mean, overall, I'm pretty over Anthony Hopkins being Hannibal. Yeah, it's like a band that had a hit song that just ends up hating that song because they have to play it so much. And so when they do, they're just not into it anymore. I think his later performances have really ruined it. But, you know, this one was still, it was still good, and giving it, you know, points for originality, since it was the first one, really. I think it holds up pretty well. Every other aspect of the movie was really good. Ted Levine was really good. Scott Glenn was good. Jodie Foster was excellent.
Wasn't she? I was impressed, even on the review, how good she really was.
Yeah, I'd forgotten how good she was.
And you know who else was good? Anthony Hopkins was good in this movie.
He was.
Because he was not so over the top as he was in Red Dragon.
No. And I'm worried about Hannibal.
Yeah, well, I know.
The next movie we're going to do.
Yeah, that's going to come with its own baggage, I think. But I'm going to go into it with a little more open arms. But a little tangent here. This was not the only movie I had problems dealing with this week before watching. Jason and Travis and I talked about... What's Eating Gilbert Grape?
Oh, I can't wait for that episode.
Well, I called Jason and I said, oh, we need to see if Travis will come on board for this one too, because he had done the one before, Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. And luckily he was gung-ho, because I was like, I might just simply be sobbing while you guys talk. Because I was preparing for it to be like a three hanky movie.
Wow. You liked it, huh?
Well, I mean, I had seen it before, so I knew it was coming, and I was just cringing, just waiting. But you'll get to hear it.
Oh, that reminds me. It was really surprising to hear you and Jason talk about Star Wars.
How so?
Was I the only one who was, like, all in on Star Wars?
Oh, no, I was all in on Star Wars, absolutely.
Okay.
What I'm not all in on is, you know, I think we talked before about remakes and things. And I don't mind remakes at all because, you know, if you like the original, you can have the original. Unless it's Star Wars. And you don't get the original movie in Star Wars. You won't be able to find it. All you'll get is the Han shot second and weird extra features that Lucas put in years and years and years later.
Yeah, and the one that really, really, makes me upset is the editing in of Hayden Christensen as the ghost Anakin.
Oh, get out of town. I didn't even know they did that.
Yeah, yeah, in Return of the Jedi.
Oh. I don't think I've seen Return of the Jedi since they put it out, since they re-released it in the theaters with better special effects, but left the claymation in.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I will always love Return of the Jedi, but that just makes me wince.
Yeah, well,
when he shows up.
I was trying to watch the first movie with Journey, and, you know, it's a little dark in the beginning of the first movie.
Episode 4 or episode 1?
Episode 4. Yeah, no, I wouldn't show my 5-year-old daughter episode 1, 2, or 3, partly because I don't think they're very good, and partly because they're tons more violent, at least in my memory. Although, like I said, it's pretty dark subject matter in episode 4.
Yeah, and Luke isn't very likable in the beginning. He's really a whiny little brat.
Oh, he is, completely. Yeah. No, he's doing the whole hero, what is it, the hero story? The hero's journey.
And I thought episode 3 was pretty good. I mean, it would definitely be the 4th ranked of the six movies, but I thought it was actually a genuine, legitimate good movie.
Here's what I didn't like about episode 3. The very, very end, the final fight, which looks like two Super Mario characters fighting against each other. It was ridiculous. Them jumping around and stuff.
Maybe.
Yeah. Also, Natalie Portman and Hayden Christensen had zero chemistry.
Yeah, that just might be Hayden Christensen's complete lack of charisma.
Yeah, it's possible. But you think that, you know, Natalie Portman is pretty good in pretty much everything else I've seen her in.
Yeah, I don't think she really cared about those movies too much.
Yeah, well, hopefully they bought her a very nice house.
I'm sure.
Just while we're off in tangent land, did you see the new trailer for Star Wars?
Yes, I did. I may or may not have made my children watch it about 8 times in a row.
What did your children think about BB-8, the robot?
Is that the Rolly one?
Yes.
They loved it.
Journey did not like it. Thought it was creepy.
No, that's funny. My children didn't really like the melted Darth Vader mask.
No. And part of what I have to deal with is Journey's best friend at daycare is a big Star Wars Rebels fan, but he insists on calling the bad guy of the Star Wars movie Dark Vader. And so Journey tries to correct me that it's really Dark Vader.
That's funny.
And I have to tell her that, no, it makes no sense that his name is not Dark Vader, but it really is Darth. And so my poor girl with a lisp doesn't like any part of that.
I bet not.
So, yeah. Plus, basically, I don't have, it's 5-year-olds. I don't really recommend them necessarily.
God, but they'll soon be 6-year-olds.
Yeah, there you go. There's hope. And there's lots of fun things about it. Have you seen the movie The Babadook?
I have not. I heard good things about it, though.
So have I. I am halfway through, and roughly halfway through. And there is so far no real supernatural element to the movie, and yet I am so on board. I don't want to give anything away, but it's basically a mother and a son story. And at times, the son is like in the back seat, kicking on her seat and like demanding things. And she, because she didn't sleep a whole lot, is just really frustrated, but trying to hold it together without snapping. And that is echoes in some of my life here and there.
That's funny. I'm pretty sure it's on Netflix now.
I think so. Yeah. Well, I recommend it. It's really interesting, and like I said, I'm only halfway through it, so the visuals really haven't started, I don't think. But it's a creepy story to begin with, so that's pretty fun.
Yeah, well, we're full off in tangent land. Speaking of good movies and 5-year-olds, I watched How to Train Your Dragon 2. That's a great movie.
Isn't it? I thought it was good. I like How to Train Your Dragon 1.
Yeah, I did too. I even bought it in 3D.
Excellent.
And on my 3D television, which is actually really good.
Cool. So you got the full 3D experience?
Yeah, but Yeah, and then I watched How to Train Your Dragon 2 on Netflix with the little ones. And it was a really good movie. I got choked up.
Yeah, excellent. And I like the fact that T.J. Miller was in both How to Train Your Dragon 2 and Big Hero 6 for the Oscars. So that's pretty great.
He's having a good year.
Yeah.
On the HBO show, too.
Oh, cool. Yeah. He's an interesting guy. I don't know how much you know about him, but he's like a...
I know. He almost died from a brain tumor.
Yep. And also, he's really philosophical. Like, he's really into nihilism and, like, Nietzsche.
Like Russ Cole?
A little bit, yeah. Yeah. So that, and, you know, his own, like, absurdist humor anyway. I don't know if you've ever heard his podcast, Cashing In with T.J. Miller.
I have not.
It's sometimes hard to take. It's comedian Cash Levy has a podcast, and the conceit of the whole show is that he's always trying to get a guest to come on, but it falls through at the last moment, so T.J. Miller shows up. And they do some fun recurring things. But quite often it goes off into like bizarro land because that's just where T.J. Miller takes things. And you don't know whether he's serious or not. And that's kind of fun, too. But like I said, it's sometimes a little goes a long way.
I'll check it out.
Yeah. But I also have the T.J. Miller song, Special Individual, in rotation in my normal music catalog because I love that song.
I don't think I've ever heard it.
It's fantastic. I would recommend that you buy it on the spot. You can be anything that you want to be. You can reach the deepest depths of the sea. Touch the stars, you can dance on bars. You can call your best friend Sarah bitch when you're in your friend Michelle's car. Cause you are the girl and you're a special individual. Also a girl and special. Cause you're unique and you're special, and you're special, and a girl, and special. And realized that he paid for the song to be written and produced and everything. I think he said he paid like $30,000 to have that done. And at least in the time he had been talking about it, had not nearly sold enough copies to actually repay that. But it was fun for him just to have an album out. And the rest of the album is interesting. It's got like some rap battles, including a funny one, a rap battle between he and Pete Holmes.
Oh.
But Special Individual is well worth getting. I think the album's called The Extended EP. So, anyway, are we get back to Silence of the Lambs then?
I'm ready.
Well, first, a little history. Prior to the novel's release, Orion Pictures partnered with Gene Hackman to buy the rights to the story. Hackman was supposed to play the role of Lecter. And they were going to split the $500,000 cost of the rights between Hackman and the studio. And then because, you know, they got the rights to the novel, but they had to also buy the rights to the name Hannibal Lecter, which were owned still by Dino De Laurentiis from Manhunter. But De Laurentiis, because Manhunter was a failure, he just let Orion Pictures have the rights for free.
Yikes.
Yeah. So I think Thomas Harris visited the FBI Behavioral Crimes Unit, Dr. Robert Keppel there at the crime unit, who was heavily involved in the Ted Bundy investigation, and he'd interview Bundy a bunch. And let's see, who was it? Was it Anthony Hopkins or Scott Glenn? Somebody said something about how it was really creepy to talk to those guys, and Keppel was like, oh, you want to hear creepy? You should listen to some recordings of Ted Bundy being interviewed. And apparently, I can't find in my notes whether it was Hopkins or Scott Glenn, but one of them said they've never been the same since. And it was not a positive experience because it was just so damn creepy.
That sounds chilling.
Yeah. Oh, and by the way, here's another thing that explains a little bit about Hopkins' performance in Red Dragon. Doesn't excuse anything, I don't think, but it explains it. When he developed the voice for Hannibal Lecter, Anthony Hopkins said he wanted to be a combination of Truman Capote and Katharine Hepburn.
That's so bizarre.
Yeah, it's an odd choice. He also saw Lecter as kind of like Hal in 2001. You know, something who knows everything about it and is really complex and intelligent, but also is a killing machine.
I can see that. We'll get to it in more detail later, but that was probably my only complaint about his performance, is about how he seemed almost omnipotent with what he knew and what he could sense. I mean, he seemed like a supervillain.
Most definitely. But I think that worked well when you paired it with Starling, who is the fish out of water. Anyway, it's worth noting that this movie won Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor, Best Actress, and Best Adapted Screenplay.
And what was it up against that year, do you know?
I don't remember, but I know it was the first movie considered a horror movie to win the Oscars, or to win the Best Picture.
Do you consider this a horror movie?
Nope. I say consider this in definitely a thriller.
Right. Yep. It was up against Bugsy.
Okay. Well.
And Prince of Tides. And for Best Actress, Jodie Foster is going up against both Gina Davis and Susan Sarandon for Thelma and Louise.
Wow. Well, I think
Anthony Hopkins beat out Robert De Niro for Cape Fear. He beat out Warren Beatty for Bugsy. He beat out Robin Williams for The Fisher King.
Wow, that's kind of a coup. That was a strong field.
Yeah, no doubt.
Who was up for Best Director that year?
John Singleton for Boys in the Hood. Oliver Stone for JFK. Yeah, Boys in the Hood, a movie that I do not think holds up.
Oh, no. Well,
Oliver Stone, JFK, Ridley Scott for Thelma and Louise, and then Barry Levinson for Bugsy.
Oh, man.
I don't think I've ever seen Bugsy, but...
I think I did.
People really loved it that year.
Yeah, I remembered a couple lines from it. I remember Annette Bening told Warren Beatty to go jerk himself a soda, and I remember Warren Beatty practicing his elocution lessons in the car because he didn't think he was very eloquent. So there's something about 12 dwarves, and it's a big thing you say, kind of like red leather, yellow leather.
Harvey Keitel and Ben Kingsley were both nominated for Best Supporting Actor from Bugsy. They lost out to Jack Palance for City Slickers.
Was that the Oscar where he did his one-handed push-up? That must have been the next year.
No, it had to have been that one.
Wow. Well, that's still quite a statement. Yeah, I don't know. I haven't seen Boys in the Hood lately, and I saw JFK fairly recently, and I really like that movie a lot. But yeah, we'll have to revisit some of these other movies, perhaps. But this was just, as far as I'm concerned, this pulled off everything. It was fun. It was interesting. It was startling, and it just kind of gave everything gave me everything I wanted in a thriller.
Yeah, no, I was really pleasantly surprised by the time this movie ended. And I had forgotten just how freaking creepy the bad guy, Gene Gum, was in this movie.
Oh,
He didn't have very much screen time, but he's got this voice that I remember now why, but every time he's in another movie, even if he's playing a goofy character, his voice just always creeps me out. Also, he was in Heat.
That's true. Also, in Monk.
I've never seen an episode.
I recommend it. It's kind of fun. It's like Murder, She Wrote. Oh, damn it. Okay. I don't know his name.
That one dude from Wings.
Yes. Tony Shalhoub. There you go. I was going to say Antonio Scarapacci. But anyway.
Was that his character on Wings?
Yeah. Anywho. By the way, this movie had a face that I recognize now, but I totally didn't recognize at the time. The girl that he kidnaps?
Yeah, she's in lots of stuff.
She is. She gained like 30 pounds for the role, too.
I can never listen to that Tom Petty song without thinking about her.
Oh, of course not. She does a good job with that, too. I liked every part of this pretty well. Okay, shall we start?
Let's do it.
Here's the criticism I have of this movie that was completely, especially after seeing Red Dragon, was a complete sort of about face. It just surprised me. this movie's title sequence looks like it's a TV movie.
It's so terrible.
Yeah, it's. I mean, I was actually looking to see, okay, when did really slick title sequences, when was it popular to have a really slick title sequence? Because I think we had talked about, or I had mentioned that the first one I remember saying, hey, this is a really slick title sequence, was Spawn.
I don't know. It had to have been a choice.
Yeah, it had. Exactly. Because, it works in the sense that it just kind of lulls you into the story. You know, you see Jodie Foster running through the woods and the titles come on like really like a TV movie.
Yeah, I mean the title sequence and you know the opening scene of her going through the obstacle course really does lull you into a feeling of a different type of movie than it actually is.
Yeah, because they could have started with a brutal killing or a kidnapping or something.
Yeah,
but they don't. They lure you in and throw breadcrumbs at you. And Jodie Foster does a really good job playing in cadet at the FBI Academy.
Yeah, she does seem a little old to be like as young and naive as they are lead you to believe she is.
It's true.
Maybe not naive, but I guess what an ingenue.
Yeah, you're right. She's like a little long in the tooth for that. But you know, this is also 1991. So the sexual politics of it have changed, you know, in the last 24 years.
Yeah, I mean, Jonathan Demme definitely beat you over the head with the imagery of always putting her like in groups of giant men to make her seem very slight.
Very effectively, though. Like that elevator scene is perfect.
Yeah, that sets the tone. And then there's the other scene with all the sheriffs.
It made me wonder where all those tall guys went when she got off the elevator and there was no one else in it, but oh well.
Pat Glenn, his version of Jack Crawford is a complete douchebag.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'd forgotten that we're dealing with a yet another Jack Crawford, because now we have four Jack Crawfords in the mix too, right?
We do. Yeah, this Jack Crawford is really, really mercenary with how he treats Starling and how he manipulates the situation to get the result that he wants. And, you know, what he does is very effective. I mean, he's good at it, but he doesn't come across as very likable.
He definitely looks more like a typical FBI agent, in my opinion. I mean, he's got the severe haircut and
Cop bad glasses.
Yeah, or military bad glasses, maybe. Yeah, so Jack calls Cadet Starling into his office at the Behavioral Science Unit, and we see that she wants to someday graduate and work for him, but he's got a little mission for her before that. And the mission is just to interview Hannibal Lecter, a former psychiatrist and incarcerated cannibalistic serial killer, just basically an interview because he's refused to do interviews.
Yeah, the guys is that they're compiling a database of psychopaths and serial killers, and he is the missing piece that will complete the project, and he won't talk to anybody. So he tells Starling that maybe she can get him to open up.
And if not, just kind of pay attention to his cell. You know, she's basically got a little scouting mission if he doesn't talk, which you don't expect him to.
Right.
So she travels down to the Baltimore State Hospital for the criminally insane. And that's where we meet Dr. Chilton, Frederick Chilton, played by Anthony Held. And he is as over the top as he is in Red Dragon.
I thought he was way worse in Red Dragon.
Well, maybe, but he's definitely a bad guy in the fact that he is manipulative and slimy and treacherous and petty.
Yes.
I mean, maybe treacherous is too strong a word, but definitely petty.
Well, yeah, he's, I think I describe him as petulant in Red Dragon, because he's a little bit like that here, and he's just kind of smarmy and annoying until Starling blows him off one too many times. And then he does betray them.
And then you get the scene of our first introduction to the wing or the cell that Lecter's at. And it's a great scene. It's fun. It's creepy. It's got those the submarine noises that you didn't really hear in Red Dragon. And the set direction on this, Christy Zea was the production designer. And Jonathan Demme was unhappy with shooting Lecter through the bars because he thought that it negated the sense of intimacy between Lecter and Starling, which he was trying to achieve, sort of separate from the Graham Lecter situation in Manhunter. So that's why they devised the glass or plexiglass or whatever that is.
Yeah, that is a little microcosm of why Manhunter is so good and Red Dragon is so shitty. And especially now watching Silence of the Lambs, which is so creative in all the ways that Red Dragon wasn't, is that in Manhunter, the bars really helped reinforce this concept that Will Graham and Hannibal Lecter were just flip sides of the same coin. And Michael Mann used the bars and set up the shots so effectively to show that they were the same person, and they were framed the exact same way in the shot, and they were both shot from the other side of the bar. So when they switched back and forth, you couldn't really tell who was in the cell and who was out of the cell. And in Silence of the Lambs, you have this burgeoning intimate relationship between young Starling and Lecter, who takes an immediate liking to her because she is so open and interesting and honest with him in ways that most people aren't, because they're just trying to get what they want. And so the use of the plexiglass really, really does show that, because they could get so close to each other. And the only thing you see between them is this really slight reflection, you know, and that just highlights the totally different dynamic between Lecter and Starling than there was between Lecter and Graham. And when Red Dragon tried to use the same set, because it was aping as much as it could from Silence of the Lambs, it totally missed that dynamic. And it was just a steaming pile of crap.
Well, and, you know, the thing that made Manhunter so much more effective than Red Dragon, I think, was that the Will Graham character was really affected by his meeting with Lecter. You know, it's like he didn't want to do it. And they, you know, they had their conversation, but the bars are really important to just show that these people know each other, and especially Graham does not like Lecter, is afraid of Lecter, and, you know, the bars are important to know that they are separated at least. And right. With, you know, Jodie Foster, Clarice Starling, has never met Lecter, so she hears rumors, but she's not familiar with his particular brand of bullshit.
Right, and she's genuinely terrified, but initially more at the creepy setting than Lecter himself.
Well, and plus, you know, he did these terrible acts that she's familiar with, so she knows that he's a bad guy, and everybody warns her that he's a bad guy, so.
Right.
And they have a really nice conversation. I mean, it's pretty great.
That expires in 1 week. You're not real FBI, are you?
I'm still in training at the academy.
Jack Crawford sent a trainee to me.
Yes, I'm a student. I'm here to learn from you. Maybe you can decide for yourself whether or not I'm qualified enough to do that.
That is rather slippery of you, Agent Starling. Sit, please. Now then, tell me, what did Miggs say to you? Multiple Miggs in the next cell. He hissed at you. What did he say?
He said, I can smell your cunt.
I see. I myself cannot. You use Evian skin cream. And sometimes you wear lead at home. But not today.
Did you do all these drawings, Doctor?
Ah. That is the Duomo scene from the Belvedere. You know Florence?
All that detail just from memory, sir?
Memory, agents, darling, is what I have instead of a view.
Well, perhaps you'd care to lend us your view on this questionnaire, sir.
No. You were doing fine. You had been courteous and receptive to courtesy. You had established trust with the embarrassing truth about Miggs. And now this ham-handed segue into your questionnaire. It won't do.
And she said that he said, I can smell your cunt. And he says, I see. I myself cannot. Which is almost a throwaway line the way he says it. Yet it's really, really effective in kind of, again, luring you in. Because in Red Dragon, he was all just up in Graham's grill. And there's no nuance to his lectorisms.
Right. And I did like that they're laying the groundwork for what is one of my favorite Lecter character traits, is that he's really displeased by people who are impolite. And so he takes umbrage with Miggs being impolite to Starling.
Yes, not the comment, but what he does later. Because Starling and Lecter's conversation kind of, you know, they go back and forth just a little bit, but she's not prepared for his level of manipulation, and he kind of seems to grow tired of the conversation. So he just gives the whole lecture about how, you know, like what you look like to me with your good bag and your cheap shoes, you look like a rube. And then he tells her after she comes back with, you know, whether or not he can face himself. And he just basically dismisses her and says, fly away, little starling, fly away. Which I think is...
Yeah, I mean, it was a great line, but he's also pretty offended that Jack Crawford sent a trainee to try and get him to to take the survey.
Yeah, but luckily for everyone, as she's leaving, Miggs flicks semen on her, which he, of course, considers unspeakably ugly and rude. And that's when he calls her back to the cell and tells her to seek out an old patient of his. So the lore of this movie is Jodie Foster claims, at least, that during the first meeting between Lecter and Starling, Anthony Hopkins' mocking of her southern accent was just an improvisation. And so her horrified reaction that she gave him when he was mocking her speech was genuine because she felt personally attacked by it.
Like he was telling her she's a bad actress.
Or just mocking him, mocking her in character, you know, exactly. So she was honestly offended, and later apparently she thanked him for getting that reaction from her.
That's funny. But yeah, one thing we didn't mention is that Lecter is really interested in this other case that Crawford is working on, the Buffalo Bill killer. And Starling doesn't know anything about it, but Lecter wants to know more. And Lecter, when he calls her back, is trying to manipulate her to get her involved in the case, as it turns out, which is a funny parallel because Crawford was using Starling to manipulate Lecter into helping them with a profile of Buffalo Bill.
So it's a double switcheroo with poor Starling in the middle, who's got to hunt right through a storage shed.
Yeah. She's just getting manipulated by everybody in this movie.
So this is where we take a trip to the storage yard where she goes in and finds a really creepy scene of the mannequin in the car and then the head in the jar.
Yes. This scene was genuinely terrifying to me when I saw it in the movie theater.
Oh, yeah. It's got like a, you know, a jump scare but it's also fairly, I mean, it lingers a little bit, so it's pretty gruesome.
Yeah, it lingers a little bit, and it's really slow to get going because they can't even open the door in the beginning because it's been closed so long. And Starling has to use a car jack to wedge it up just enough to crawl underneath it. And so it's really creepy and claustrophobic to begin with. And then they definitely take their time inside the storage shed. I mean, you just felt like something was going to go horribly wrong. And then all of a sudden they reveal a head in a jar out of nowhere.
Yeah. And, turns out this head is a former patient of Lecter who he claims not to have killed. Now, the implication is that Buffalo Bill killed him. So now, okay, was Buffalo Bill ever Lecter's patient?
He tells the senator later that he saw him once.
Ah.
I mean, if you believe Hannibal Lecter is being a reliable narrator at that point, then I guess technically he was a patient for one session. But, you know, I have no confidence that he was being truthful with the senator. So.
Oh, no, not at all. Yeah. And luckily, the funny thing is, when asked about whether or not he killed his patient, he's like, no, you know, I didn't kill him. But, I mean, it was no great loss. He was a bad patient. Very boring.
Yeah.
So,
he must have been a great psychiatrist.
Oh, yeah. Well, we're going to talk about that a little bit later. So then we get our first glimpse of Buffalo Bill as he, in a very creepy scene, abducts a U.S. senator's daughter, Catherine Martin, played by Brooke Smith. Most notably, at least to me, as being one of the doctors on Grey's Anatomy that has a lesbian relationship with another doctor on Grey's Anatomy, whose name of that actress I don't know, but.
Another show I've never seen an episode of.
Yeah, that's not nearly as worthwhile, I don't think. It's fine, but, you know, I think it's kind of a product of its times, if I remember correctly. It's another medical soap opera, so.
She was on a couple of the early seasons of Weeds.
Oh. See, I never got into that. I owned the first season of it, and I gave it away because I just didn't like it at all. Yeah, well, although the person I gave it to ended up watching it with her daughters, watched the whole series, like as a bonding thing. So, you know, it had some value.
Weird. It's one of the only shows that I was able to cut the line on later. I mean, I never finished it. I think I watched all but the last two seasons, but I was able to get out.
Good for you. You're one of those people that go to the end, right? You don't leave a book unfinished either?
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes. It's making me anxious just talking about the fact that I didn't finish it.
I used to be like that, but then I realized, especially with books, that there are so many books out there that suffering through a bad one really isn't worth the trouble in my mind. But so, and I definitely don't carry that into movies. There are plenty of movies that I've stopped watching halfway through.
Good for you.
Yeah. Well, although, you know, With the calendar and the podcast, don't get that opportunity like I used to.
Yeah, so, I understand that.
Yeah. So, Crawford authorizes Starling to offer Lecter a deal, promising a prison transfer, because basically what Lecter wants is to get away from Chilton. You know, he'd like a view, which would be nice, because he knows they're never going to let him out of prison. But he's willing to accept someplace away from Chilton. So she offers him this crazy deal where he gets to not only have a view, but also have, what, one week a year or 2 weeks a year on a private island where he can get in touch with wildlife.
Yeah, it's on an animal disease research center is the only other thing on the island.
Yeah, well. So I think later he calls it Anthrax Island. But instead, though, Lecter says great, but what he really wants is a quid pro quo from Starling, where Starling gives up personal information about herself in exchange for information he's going to give her about Buffalo Bill.
Right. He wants that intimate back and forth with Clarice, whom he has taken a shine to.
Yeah. And he is a psychiatrist after all, so, you know, he has those skills. So, Starling starts telling Lecter about the murder of her father when she was 10 years old. And this is where Chilton starts to cause problems, because he records their conversations and ends up basically telling Lecter that, oh no, you know, this is all bullshit. I talked to the senator. Senator didn't authorize any kind of deal. So Chilton's got his own deal with the senator, and Lecter agrees as long as he is meeting with the senator in Memphis, Tennessee. And the scene between Lecter and the senator, played very well by Diane Baker, very sort of Hillary Clinton-esque, or maybe even maybe Elizabeth Dole, but...
Yeah, maybe.
Senator Martin, Dr. Hannibal Lecter.
Dr. Lecter, I brought an affidavit guaranteeing your new rights. You want to read it before I sign.
I won't waste your time or Catherine's time bargaining for petty privileges. Clarice Starling and that awful Jack Crawford have wasted far too much time already. I only pray they haven't doomed the poor girl. Let me help you now, and I will trust you when it is all over.
You have my word, Paul.
Buffalo Bill's real name is Lewis Friend. I met him just once. He was referred to me in April or May 1980 by my patient Benjamin Raspel. They were lovers, you see. But Raspel had become very frightened. Apparently, Lewis had murdered a transient and done things with the skin.
We need his address and a physical description.
Tell me, Senator, did you nurse Catherine yourself?
What?
Did you breastfeed her?
Now, wait a minute.
Yes, I did.
Toughened your nipples, didn't it?
Oh, son of a bitch.
Amputate a man's leg and he can still feel it tickling. Tell me, Mom, when your little girl is on the slab, where will it tickle you?
Take this thing back to Baltimore.
5'10", strongly built, about 180 pounds. Hair blonde, eyes pale blue. He'd be about 35 now. He said he lived in Philadelphia, but may have lied. That's all I can remember, Ma. But if I think of any more, I will let you know. Oh, and Senator, just one more thing. Love your suit.
So creepy.
It is super creepy. And then he ends with the best line ever as far as love your suit. I mean, I think it's so awesome.
Yeah, I mean, this is the iconic scene where he's strapped to the dolly and he has the Hannibal Lecter mask on. And so he really is only acting with his voice and his eyes. And that line is so great because he gives the little eyebrow nod at the end of it.
Oh yeah, it's fantastic. And okay, the one part of the movie and the novel that I didn't like is really the anagram element to Hannibal Lecter.
Yeah, I mean, it's, after sneakers, they should just retire anagrams from movies.
Yeah, I think so. But Starling, who, by the way, you know, because that relationship, she lied to the person who's interviewing, which sours any relationship. You can't be a good negotiator if you lie to people. We learn that in The Negotiator. So Starling goes to meet Lecter kind of on the sly. She has to talk her way into his very elaborate cell in a Tennessee courthouse.
Is it in a courthouse or is it in a museum?
Well, I think it was a courthouse, but yeah, it looks very old. And they had cleared that whole area where they erected the cell. First of all, you know, stunt casting, Chris Isaac as one of the SWAT guys or the SWAT leader or whatever. But I thought the cop, you know, with the mustache, the sergeant or whatever.
Tate. Yes, Tate.
Yes.
He was great.
Wasn't he?
And I don't know that I've ever seen him in anything else, but yeah, when I was rewatching this to talk about it, I totally forgot about him, and he was so good in every scene.
Oh, absolutely. And he also looks like an officer that I knew that who is no longer an officer. We don't have to get into why. Him being a cop seemed perfectly well cast as far as I was concerned.
He shines when the shit goes down. So he's not like a bumbling local. I mean, he's great.
Yeah, no, he's a police sergeant. He knows what to do. Well, he's a leader of men, right?
Absolutely.
So anyway, so Clarice comes in and talks to Lecter, and they continue their whole quid pro quo thing. And that's where she gives her great speech about the incident where they were slaughtering the spring lambs and she had to run away.
People will say we're in love. Anthrax Island. That was an especially nice touch, Clarice. Yours?
Yes.
Yeah. That was good. Pity about poor Catherine, though. Tick-tock, 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 tick-tock.
Your anagrams are showing, Doctor. Lewis Friend. Iron Sulfide, also known as Fool's Gold.
Oh, Clarice, your problem is you need to get more fun out of life.
You were telling me the truth back in Baltimore, sir. Please continue now.
Well, I've read the case files, have you? Everything you need to find him is right there in those pages.
And tell me how.
First principles, Clarice. Simplicity. Read Marcus Aurelius. Of each particular thing, ask, what is it in itself? What is its nature? What does he do, this man you seek?
He kills women.
No, that is incidental. What is the first and principal thing he does? What needs does he serve by killing?
Anger. Social acceptance and sexual frustrations.
No, he covets. That is his nature. And how do we begin to covet, Clarice? Do we seek out things to covet? Make an effort to answer now.
No. We just...
No. We begin by coveting what we see every day. Don't you feel eyes moving over your body, Clarice? And don't your eyes seek out the things you want?
All right, yes. And please tell me how.
No. It is your turn to tell me, Clarice. You don't have any more vacations to sell. Why did you leave that ranch?
Doctor, we don't have any more time for any of this now.
But we don't reckon time the same way, do we, Clarice? This is all the time you'll ever have.
Later. Now, please, listen to me. We've only got five...
No. I will listen now. After your father's murder, you were orphaned. You were 10 years old. You went to live with cousins on a sheep and horse ranch in Montana. And?
And one morning, I just ran away.
Not just, Clarice. What set you off? You started at what time?
Early, still dark.
Then something woke you, didn't it? Was it a dream? What was it?
I heard a strange noise.
What was it?
It was screaming. Some kind of screaming, like a child's voice.
What did you do?
I went downstairs, outside. I crept up into the barn. I was so scared to look inside, but I had to.
What did you see, Clarice? What did you see?
Lambs. They were screaming.
They were slaughtering the spring lambs?
And they were screaming.
And you ran away?
No. First, I tried to free them. I opened the gate to their pen, but they wouldn't run. They just stood there, confused. They wouldn't run.
But you could, and you did, didn't you?
Yes. I took one lamb, and I ran away as fast as I could.
Where were you going, Clarice?
I don't know. I didn't have any food, any water, and it was very cold. Very cold. I thought if I could save just one, but he was so heavy. So heavy. I didn't get more than a few miles when the sheriff's car picked me up. Rancher was so angry, he sent me to live at the Lutheran Orphanage in Postman. I never saw the ranch again.
What became of your lamb, Clarice?
I killed him.
You still wake up sometimes, don't you? You wake up in the dark and hear the screaming of the lamb.
Yes.
And you think if you save poor Catherine, you could make them stop, don't you? You think if Catherine lives, you won't wake up in the dark ever again to that awful screaming of the
lambs. I don't know. I don't know.
Thank you, Clary. Thank you.
Which is a great way to get a title of a movie slash novel.
Yeah, and did you think there's a visual callback to that later on?
Where would that have been?
When, what was the name of the senator's daughter?
What was her name? Catherine Martin?
Catherine, yeah. When she is holding the dog.
Oh, yeah, maybe so, yes.
I mean, it's sort of like the same posture as the sketch, the hilarious sketch that, that Lecter draws of Clarice with the lamb.
Catherine Martin's character is great. I mean, she's just like Tate. I mean, she's not going to give up. And, you know, when we cut back to the whole Buffalo Bill, and I, of course, remembered the line, even I think I was repeating the line as we were leaving the theater about it puts the lotion on the skin or else it gets the hose again.
No, I don't doubt that you were repeating that while chuckling.
Oh, it was great. It was a great line at the time. It was a great line ever since. And since then, though, especially when I first discovered Pete Holmes' podcast, who, I really recommend, although, you know, it's hit or miss sometimes because it's a long podcast. You have to kind of commit to it. But he would always refer to, it puts the lotion in the basket. And I'd be like, that is not the line, you idiot. Turns out it is the line. It's a line like two beats later.
Right.
It rubs the lotion on its skin. It does this whenever it's told.
Mister, my family will pay cash. Whatever ransom you're asking for, they'll pay it.
It rubs the lotion on its skin or else it gets the hose again.
Yes, you will, precious. You will get the hose.
Okay. Okay. Mister, if you let me go, I won't press charges, I promise. See, my mom is a real important woman. I guess you already know that.
Now it places the lotion in the basket.
Please. I want to go home, please.
It places the lotion in the basket.
I want to see my mommy. Please, no. I want to see my...
Put the fucking lotion in the basket!
It's such a great performance by Ted Levine, because as described by Lecter, he is not at peace with himself. He has identity issues, so he thinks he's a transsexual, but he's not really. But that's what he's striving for. He's striving to transform himself into a woman. And so when he's initially talking to the captive, Catherine Martin, down in the pit, he's sort of affecting this feminine voice as he's referring to her as it. And then when he gets frustrated, he just explodes with, put the fucking lotion in the van. And it's so chilling the way he does it.
Oh, yeah. I think he's like spitting or slobbering or something as he's doing it because he's so exasperated.
Yes.
As he's stroking his dog, Precious. But, you know, the other thing, you know, Senator Martin, when she gives her plea over the air about, you know, her daughter and keeps mentioning her name and how, and the other agents or Clarice's study partner, whatever, is like, oh, that's really brilliant that she's humanizing her. And then later you see the scene where he's talking to her about it puts the lotion on its skin, where he's dehumanizing her. And I thought that was really well. I mean, I thought this was my introduction, I'm sure, to the whole, you know, behavioral unit of the FBI and the mind hunter kind of thing. John Douglas's book came later.
That's who Crawford's supposed to be, right?
I think so. Yeah. Yep. I think he's based on John Douglas. I think actually that's it. Maybe Scott Glenn spent some time with John Douglas, who then said, oh yeah, if you want to really hear something crazy, you listen to these tapes. So, you know, Lecter gives her back her case files as they drag Clarice off because she's bluffed her way into the whole meeting with Lecter. And then we get the scene where Lecter kills the police officers.
Well, the important part of when Hannibal gives the case files back is he actually gets to touch Clarice.
That's true.
Is that really... He gets a little brief, little swipe of their hands touching.
And since he hasn't even seen a woman in 8 years, that's pretty, you know, that gives you kind of a charge.
Right. And since he already thinks she's fascinating, that he definitely has the hots for her.
Yeah. Well, we'll learn in later movies that there's some craziness going on. But the scene of him killing the officers is an amazing scene. That whole segment where it's, you know, they're playing what, the opera music, and
right.
It's very operatic, and like the way he holds the baton is just chilling and perfect.
Yeah. And what made it so disturbing was he's like, until this point in the movie, they sort of talk about how brutal a murderer he can be, and that's why they take all these physical precautions with him. But the only thing the audience has experienced from him is being sort of this cerebral criminal mastermind. You know, he's able to pick apart Clarice's, you know, innermost thoughts, and he's really perceptive. He's more psychologically terrifying than anything else. And then, almost out of nowhere, he just explodes into this gruesome violence. I mean, it was shockingly graphic.
And even though he's pretty, you know, light on his feet, he's also, I mean, he's kind of short, but he is a little bit more stocky than you really know. I mean, he seems to be a little more built than you originally think.
Right. Yeah. I mean, when he is not bound to a vertical gurney, he's physically imposing when he has a free rein of movement.
Yeah. Yeah. He's probably doing those G. Gordon Liddy exercises in his jail cell to keep himself toned.
He must.
Yes. And then Starling realizes that Lecter has annotated her case files, and she discovers that the first victim, he must have known personally, and that he's building a suit of real skin, sort of a Ed Gein kind of thing, I believe, kind of thing.
Right. That's how he's going to transform into a woman. He's building himself a woman suit out of skin.
Yes. And we get that creepy scene of him parading in front of the mirror with his legs crossed.
Oh, yeah, that was... I did not remember the tuck.
Oh, yeah.
I must have just erased that from my memory.
Well, there's so much else going on. But, yeah, it's like, oh, this is super creepy.
Yeah, Ted Levine, he's not in the movie very much, but he owns every scene he's in.
Oh, yeah. No, he is the real monster in the movie. I mean, Lecter comes off. I mean, I can see why people wanted more Lecter, because Lecter is charming. James Gunn is not charming at all.
No. Yeah, and Lecter is so uniquely charming as an anti-hero. Because he helps Clarice catch him.
Oh, totally, yeah.
He does horrible things to other people, but, you know, you're rooting for Clarice, and Hannibal actually helps her further her career and catch the bad guy that everybody wants to catch.
Oh, yeah, you know, he's on her side, too. But I love, you know, when she actually goes to the house next door to the house of Jack Gordon. She, you know, when she finds out, oh, we missed the whole part about the moths. The moths I thought were kind of interesting. They explained the poster. They put everything together. But what I thought was interesting is, you know, the death head moths have that kind of a skull pattern on them.
Yeah.
But the poster is not of that. The skull on the poster is from the Salvador Dali painting with the nude women who look like a skull when you look far enough away.
Didn't The Descent?
That's exactly what it was. Too? Yeah, I knew it from The Descent, but really it's Salvador Dali who made that popular. Really, really interesting. I mean, it's a really, really good visual, but it's interesting that they took the Dali painting and just shrunk it down and put it on the moth for the poster. So, good work for them. Really, Lecter would have appreciated that.
Yeah, I mean, we definitely skipped over some plot points, but there, watch the movie. It's worth it.
Yeah, no, I mean, we can go back if you want. There's this one line in particular that I love. And that's when Starling first talks to James Gunn. She asked him, as Jack Gordon, so Frederica used to work for Miss Lipham. Did you know her?
Good afternoon. Sorry to bother you. I'm looking for Mrs. Lipman's family.
No, Lipmans don't live here anymore.
Excuse me, sir. I really need to speak with you.
What's the problem, officer?
Well, I'm investigating the death of Frederica Bimmel. Your name is?
Oh, Jack Gordon.
Mr. Gordon. Good. Well, Frederica used to work for Mrs. Lipman. Did you know her?
No, uh-uh. Oh, wait. Was she a great big fat person?
Yeah, she was a big girl, sir.
Yeah, I miss. No, I read about her in the newspaper.
Just his manner of speech is just amazing. So, anyway, the ending is pretty much what you want in an ending. I mean, we can go through it if you want, but really it's, you got a little bit of night vision goggle action, and there's some, you know, the final confrontation in the basement. And when Clarice finds Catherine Martin, and Catherine Martin freaks the hell out, like, you're not going to leave me alone.
Yeah, she's definitely a little spitfire all the way to the end.
Absolutely.
When she realizes that Clarice isn't immediately going to help get her out of the pit, she gets really ticked off.
Yeah, well, she's maybe not then, but she sees the video games. You know, you leave the person there and you get killed later. You may respawn, but the person's still there in the pit.
Indeed.
Yeah, hey, call for backup, lady. Something, you know. It doesn't seem like good procedure.
Yes, in the days before ubiquitous cell phones.
Yes. That's what makes this movie great. They don't have to explain away the cell phone problem. Then we get the FBI graduation party after the shootout with Gum.
Yeah, we didn't even talk about how Lecter escaped.
Oh, yeah, you're right. I kind of glossed over that when we talked about the violence. But yeah, no, he escaped in a... This is kind of a horror movie sort of trope, I think, where he ends up donning the face of one of the officers.
Yeah, that was a great, great switcheroo. I did not see that coming the first time we watched it in the theater.
Oh, no. Not at all. And then when he pops up in the ambulance, it's amazing. And, you know, when asked, well, I think her roommate asks Clarice whether she's worried that Lecter's going to come after her. She's like, no, he wouldn't come after me. He would consider that rude.
Yeah. So she's got his number just as much as he has hers.
Yes. Anyway, I totally remembered this from the theater, because this is before I watched a lot of Food Network, maybe even before there was a lot of Food Network. But the FBI graduation cake, that was a stunning piece of artwork to get the FBI, you know, symbol, logo, whatever it is. The seal of the FBI in cake form is fantastic.
Yes, that was a great looking cake.
Yeah.
Way before the days where just any local grocery store could screen print anything they want onto a cake.
Oh yeah, no, it was definitely worthy of a Cake Boss or a Duff.
Yes, and very nicely sliced too.
Oh yeah, it was a shame to slice it, but they sliced it well.
I just cannot believe that the real FBI Academy is anything like the way it's portrayed in this movie.
Yeah, you know, I don't know.
From like all of like the only classes you see in the Academy are essentially physical training.
Well, that's true. I mean, I'm sure they leave a lot of the bookwork out of it, but I assume.
Yeah, and then a super extravagant graduation ceremony. I mean, it looks great. I don't believe it. Maybe it's true.
We have a pretty elaborate graduation ceremony for our officers. I mean, you're all dressed up and you bring your family and the mayor's there and they shake your hand and give you awards. And it's pretty impressive. It's something that you definitely invite your family and they dress up for.
All right. Well, I'm happy to be wrong.
I assume the FBI Academy is like a lot of law enforcement academies where there's a pretty good washout rate.
I would hope so.
So she receives a phone call at this party. And who is it but our buddy Lecter, who is in an airport in Bimini. And he assures her that he does not plan to pursue her and asks her to return the favor, which she says she cannot do. But then he mentions that he's going to have an old friend for dinner and then hangs up and we see that he's following Chiltern through the crowd.
Yeah, I have a theory. I have a theory about this. That was a great walkout line. And I'm assuming that got a tremendous reaction from the audience in the theater when he laid that pun down on people. And I think the producers fell so in love with the audience reaction to that single line that they took that attitude of that pun and made two more movies based upon just that single aspect of Hannibal Lecter and ruined the character.
It's quite possible. Now, we have to blame Thomas Harris for part of that, but I imagine he got an incredible advance to write Hannibal. He had to have. Because I'm sure he didn't get a ton of money. I mean, he probably got some money from Red Dragon and then a certain amount from Silence of the Lambs. But he definitely, you know, Hannibal, I think, was his big, the big advance back when book publishing was a lot more lucrative than I think it is today.
Yeah, I can see it. I mean, he wrote Hannibal after Silence of the Lambs was a big hit at the movie theaters, right?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, so yeah, then he's got this intellectual property that people want more of. And yeah, sure, it was a good payday for him.
Yeah, I mean, and I think he's a pretty reclusive guy. I don't begrudge him, but I'm guessing that he spent a lot of his advance money, of course, in Italy and eating expensive cheeses and whatnot. Because we're going to get to hear a lot about that crap in the next movie, probably less in the movie than in the book, because the book was really, really thick with that kind of stuff.
I'm glad I never read it.
There was a little bit of backlash about this movie. The LGBT community was not happy with Buffalo Bill being portrayed as transsexual, as bad guy. And Jonathan Demme initially replied that, hey, he's not a gay character. He's a tormented guy who hates himself. He wishes a woman. And that would have made him as far away from himself as he possibly could be. So get off my back, you bastards. Well, I added that last little part. But turns out that did not have the right tone. So he came back sometime later saying that he did come to realize that there's a tremendous absence of positive gay characters in movies.
Well, that's funny because Clarice and Lecter have actually a little back and forth about whether or not Buffalo Bill is a transsexual, because Clarice says very explicitly that transsexuals are known to be very peaceful and not be psychopaths, and Lecter corrects her and agrees and says, yes, he's not a true transsexual. He has identity problems and thinks he is, but that he would have failed any of the psychological testing that the hospitals that do gender reassignment surgery do to their patients before they will have the surgery.
These days, at least if you believe Kevin Smith, he would just have to back up a nice little statement with a big check to GLAAD and basically pay that off.
So cynical.
Yeah, well, in Jay and Silent Bob, he said that, you know, because the three or four women were lesbians, like his wife among them, he basically had to write a $10,000 check to GLAAD to get them off his back. So he sort of insinuated that they were extortionists. Some more stunt casting. We already talked a little bit about Chris Isaac as the FBI, or I guess SWAT guy probably. But George Romero was an FBI agent in Memphis. And Roger Corman was FBI Director Hayden Burke.
I had no idea.
Yeah. There was basically the only one mainstream critic to give this movie a negative review. This would be like the top critics on Rotten Tomatoes. Only one. And it was Gene Siskel.
Wow. I didn't even know he was still alive when this came out.
Yep.
I remember Ebert liking it, so
yep.
It couldn't have been him.
Now, I don't know what Ebert's review looked like or what Siskel's review looked like either. But it was, it's just interesting to note. I think that's pretty much it as far as The Silence of the Lambs talk. I mean, it really held up as far as I was concerned. I was really glad to watch it and was relieved that Anthony Hopkins' performance, when you watch Red Dragon, and probably when we watch Hannibal next week, is going to be considered something of a subtle performance.
Absolutely.
So, and it's too bad that Jodie Foster didn't come back to do Hannibal, although I'm sure we're going to find out why, because that movie has some problems.
Yeah, I haven't seen it in a long time, but I don't know. I'm glad this is my lasting memory of Clarice Starling.
Yeah.
Because I mean, the character in Hannibal, it doesn't seem like the same character at all. So,
well, yeah.
The casting seems fine.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. Because, yeah. Anyway, yeah, we'll talk about Hannibal next time. And I'm going to have to avoid talking about the Hannibal TV show until we talked about that. Because I'm really enjoying it and did not see some things coming, but we're not going to talk about that tonight, unfortunately.
How far along are you?
I'm only three episodes in, but still, I can see where you said that they took some liberties with the original source material.
Did you have it on DVD, right?
Yes.
Did you watch, there's an audio commentary for the first episode. Did you watch that at all?
I did not.
There, I did, and one of my favorite nuggets is that they're talking about references, like the very first scene with Will Graham, where he's talking about the family that was murdered in the house. They say in the audio commentary he is describing a murder by Francis Dolarhyde. It's a tooth fairy murder, and they said that so they will be revisiting that in season four.
In season four?
Yeah, so in the pilot episode, they're already planning to get to the Red Dragon storyline in season four.
Wow, that's pretty optimistic of them.
No kidding, especially since it was on NBC.
Yeah, yeah. So I don't want to talk, like I said, I don't want to talk too much about it right now because I don't know enough about it to avoid even having you spoil it for me by accident. But I can see why you're taken with it. I'm taken with it as well.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear it. Episode 4 was not shown on TV.
Oh, okay.
Because it dealt with subject matter that, because of some current events at the time that happened that was national news, they did not think it was appropriate to show that episode. So, yeah, with my season rewatch, it was the first time I had seen episode 4.
Oh, which sweet.
It's a great episode.
Well, I'm just about headed there, so that'll be excellent. I might watch that tonight. So are we done with Silence of the Lambs?
I'm done.
Okay, I am too.
It was great. I was happy that it held up.
Yeah, me too.
And I enjoyed watching it again.
Send your feedback to show@notinthecreepyway.com or call us on a new voicemail account to leave voice messages. Or you can text us at this account to leave text messages. The number is 425-243-9169. That's 425-243-9169. What are you waiting for? Put it in your phone right now, and then when you listen to an episode, you can just hit your contacts. Dial it already.